thanks a lot, Bruce, for the invitation today, and I really appreciate getting to go after two really interesting talks that follow along the same lines as what I want to talk about. So we're going to delve into this a little bit more, and what I'm going to present to you guys today is a bit of my personal view, my forecast, somewhat a synthesis of some of the things that I've been working on over the years, and just some observations to kind of kickstart either some discussion or you guys thinking along the same lines and see if we can make progress in this area. I'd like to acknowledge my co-authors, Dr. Lisa Chambers. Some of the work I'm going to show you today is actually from her dissertation. She's now at the University of Central Florida in Orlando. And then also Lorraine Simpson, who is a mangrove ecologist in my laboratory doing her PhD. Okay, so I start with this one because in the coastal zones where we live, I constantly look out and see how is this landscape going to persist in the future. And I know we're talking about millimeters of sea level rise per year, but in certain places, and I'm gonna focus on Florida. You know, I see a couple of Southerners in here today, so a couple of Florida folks, and I'm excited about that. But in our area, coastal zones often have tremendously organic soil deposits there. I mean, these soils in the Everglades and in other marshes and river systems in the state are definitely organic dominated. And so when I look at the processes involved, I tend to think that this may be the case, not only the water rising, but the ground disappearing. So, and it's timely, too. I don't know if you guys saw, I grabbed this copy of National Geographic on the airplane ride up here, and it's all about climate change. And so as a society, we keep coming back to this. I think as a group of scientists, this has been on our forefront for quite a while, but it continues to motivate questions. And the questions I want to talk about today are several, but they're all kind of central. And that is, how will saline transgression events in fresh and brackish water alter carbon dynamics? And so this is important at the level of soil accretion in areas like the Everglades that Donnie talked about, and in all systems, right? And then also, how will that increasing salinity affect soil stability and nutrient cycling? Finally, I think it's increasing salinity will have tremendous effects on vegetation and the processes that build soils, especially in some of these organically dominated systems like the Everglades. There's a big change coming, and it is. We saw in the first talk already how that's happening. So this is kind of the preachy part, but I think everybody knows some of the ecological effects of sea level rise that we were seeing already. The reports are out in the literature now. But we fundamentally understand that the alteration of biogeochemical processes is a central thing. And around carbon, there's also nitrogen, phosphorus, and sulfur processes. The shifts in vegetation community structure can be tremendous. And there's a basic transferal of species distribution from salt intolerance to salt tolerance. And that changes a lot of things. At the most basic level, it changes the quality and quantity of organic matter added to the system. And for organic soils and soil accretion, this is a big process. And the last thing I want to kind of touch on is destabilization of organic soils. And I think Donnie alluded to this quite a bit in his talk. But there are biotic and abiotic processes at play that are changing those organic soil resources. So we'll talk about that some too. But so straight from the beginning, I use this slide on everything. I borrowed from Ramesh and Ron DeLon from their book. But that I see carbon as kind of a central piece in the puzzle. So organic matter in soils, whether they be mineral soils or organic dominated soils, is central to a lot of processes. So physical, chemical, and biological processes. That's how we get to do biogeochemistry and have jobs. But climate change, carbon sequestration, aquatic system eutrophication, those are all the big issues that are tied in, right? And so when salt water ends up in freshwater systems, and that's where I want to start my discussion, we see a couple of things happening. One, there's a salt effect, and this is on the bacteria that are actually doing the work of nutrient cycling, right? So we expect to see some osmotic stress. That can be cell lysis. It can be metabolic or enzyme activity related. We also see the sulfate effect, which is adding a terminal electron acceptor in the absence of oxygen that helps cook this up, right? So we speed up mineralization processes at the expense of methanogenesis, which for climate issues is not such a terrible thing. This work, and Karen, you'll appreciate the 3.5 parts per thousand. I did not see the most change in that level, but it was one that we thought, well, you know, small additions of salt can have a tremendous effect. We found that in a later study. But this, what I want to point out with this particular study is that a short pulse of salt water can have quite an effect on metabolism, but it's a short-lived one. Okay, it happens pretty rapidly, and then there's a change or shift in those microbial communities, and we don't see after the first week a lot of loss of carbon from respiration. But now that seawater, that sulfate, which we haven't really looked at in this study, we don't know how much sulfate's left. So it may be that was terminal, we used it all up, and therefore it's gone. If this is a repeating cycle, though, you can see that if this is the respiration rate versus that as a control, then we're accelerating decomposition processes, right? Okay, so one take-home from that is just that salt water does have an effect. The other one that I want to show you is not so much the high tide, the pulse treatment at the low tide in freshwater systems seems to be quite the accelerant for respiration. And the major point here is that this is at 13 parts per thousand instead of 26. So lots of salt in this particular study wasn't as effective as a little. Okay, and so as we did not check the lower levels of salt, I can't comment on that. But what I take from that is that in most applications of sea level rise and increased frequency of saltwater transgression events, we see brackish water making its way to the freshwater wetlands, not necessarily a full blast of saltwater, unless it were an extreme event like a hurricane, right? So I think that's more realistic of what's happening. So observations there were that freshwater microbial populations respond quickly. It's less than 2 weeks. Bam, something happens, and then that salinity pulse is gone, and the changes are gone there too. However, low salinity induced more carbon mineralization than freshwater or high salinity treatments over time. So when we repeated that experiment several times, we saw that was the largest change came from 3.5 parts per thousand. All right, and then the landward migration of seawater, I think this is a no-brainer, but it's going to have a significant effect on carbon balance in coastal wetlands. And that's something that I think we're seeing in all the systems, whether they be organic tropical wetlands like the Everglades or across the eastern seaboard. Now, what got me kind of interested in this is I teach an intro soils class, and I was flipping through Brady and Weil. Everybody here has had that book, I'm sure, right? And I came across these figures, and wow, you know, what is going on with these organic soils? Why are they so reactive with salt water? And so I started thinking about some of the basic principles that we talk about in agriculture and potentially applying some of those. Now, I didn't do a bunch of work with these, but I put them up there to kind of jog our memories about things that happen with increased salinity, and not just salinity, but sodium as well. Okay. Now, some previous work that was done in the Everglades, we're using Everglades soils and ag effluents from the agricultural areas to the north of the Everglades, often bring in a little bit of increased salinity. And it's small, so we're looking at specific conductance changes way down low, less than a part per thousand on the scale for salt. Okay, and we noticed that under different exposures in the lab, there was a pretty exceptional change in dissolved organic matter coming off of those soils. And this is purely an extraction. Has anybody ever done potassium sulfate extractable carbon in their lab for soils? And this is a common process we use to describe organic matter in soils, right? And so there's a principle there that's useful, and we've been doing it for quite a while. Maybe another, I guess, a more interesting look at that process would be trying to tease apart different cations and anions and seeing what the response was. And so in that same study from Loxahatchee National Wildlife Refuge, we took some intact cores from sawgrass-dominated marshes and exposed them to different salt regimes, right? And so the 200 and 1200 represent the specific conductance, and then the KCl is the actual salt that we used. And so things were pretty common and not a lot of difference there, except with the respect of carbonates. So potassium carbonates really blew it up. And so pH changes associated with that, et cetera. The second thing we wanted to know was if there was any physical change to these soils. And what was really interesting about this is that using soils and small collars, I'll show you a picture of that next, we noticed that soil volume changed tremendously with addition of salt. Now, I want to add that these soils are in polycarbonate core tubes, right? And they all started at surface. And as we increase salinity treatments, these soils actually expanded in volume. This is a completely abiotic process. So there's sodium azide in these treatments. And no biological gas production to expand these soils. Okay, so this was an abiotic process in response to salinity. So that got my brain kind of thinking about some of the classic soil organic matter stuff that we learned in school. And so I'm going to present to you kind of an idea about what we've seen in patterns in landscape in South Florida and the Everglades and why that is. And it all revolves around cation exchange with soil organic matter. So here we go. Here's a classic example of some complex soil organic matter. There's some calcium out there. There's other less abundant anions, or cations, I'm sorry. And then you add this tremendously strong ionic solution, right? So here comes our saltwater intrusion event. It could be 3.5 parts per thousand. It could be 30. Either way, something happens. So we're going to flood these soils with positively charged cations, and then we're going to have some net surface charge that goes positive and potentially disperses some of these materials. And I'm going to show you a visual indicator of that process in just a second. Now, over some of these experiments, I saw low-level increases in salinity catalyzing dissolved organic carbon flux. This is kind of a precursor to that idea. This is where we're seeing conformational changes in organic matter in the soil, and that's an indicator of that. And there's also some phosphorus flux in variable. It's based on the ions present. These are more nutrient flux-oriented type processes. But I think sodium has something to do here with the process. And I think that it may be the inducer of the dispersion that plays into what Donnie mentioned as peak collapse in the previous talk. And this is something that I'm very interested in, although we haven't done a lot of research in this yet, hoping to do a little bit more. So I mentioned vegetation changes, and these changes are part of the story with peak collapse in these organic soil systems. And so let's start with one of the stresses on wetland vegetation, right? It's not so much water stress as it is potentially sodium toxicity at the cellular level. But we also note that there are changes in soil condition, kind of precursors to this peak collapse. And I'm calling them, just for this purpose, inhospitable soil conditions. This is a loss of soil structure. And we remember, that at some salinity level, every plant loses some productivity, right? And this is another example from our general textbook. But when we get past this level of salinity or sodicity in soils, we're going to see a dramatic change in vegetation. So those saltwater tolerant plants like mangroves have an upper hand in these systems versus the traditional sawgrass or other emergent macrophytes in the marshes. And so I want to draw your attention to the same area that Donnie mentioned before. Now, this is the southern Everglades. This is Miami. And this is a freshwater marsh. So this is Shark Slough. For 5,000 years, water's been flowing south. And this shoreline has been out here somewhere, as we predict. But this is the interface between freshwater and saltwater. And it's changing. It's on a constant trajectory of change. And I talked about this subject at an Everglades meeting recently, and just days before the conference, my four-year-old daughter, I was showing her Google Earth, and she said, "Daddy, that looks really weird. It looks like the land is washing away." And when you look at it closely, it does kind of look that way. Now, this is a tremendous resource. This is organic soils. These are, in the Everglades vernacular, we call them peat. Luckily, Wade Hurst's not here to throw something at me. They don't really constitute peats, but they are, I think their organic matter content is something like 98%, right? So these are really, really organic soils, some of them deep, and we move out of this sawgrass plain into what's turning into mangroves along these rivers or creeks, and then open water. In this transition zone, if you look at it closely, let's go back and look at that little transect. First sight, north, freshwater. These shrubs are mangroves. They're just starting to creep into a sawgrass marsh. And as we look down, I don't know if you guys can see that in the back. I was hoping we'd have a big screen. But these are little ponds forming. And this is overlaid. There are actually canopies of small mangroves growing with almost open water continuous underneath them in small, shallow ponds. And as we traverse across that transect, and I'll flip back to show you, just give you a reminder, we're going from freshwater to brackish water saline systems in Florida Bay. We end up with these, you know, kind of concentrations of bigger pools of water. So something's going on here, and that process, unfortunately, is not transferring from one dominant vegetation like sawgrass to another dominant vegetation of mangrove. There are big gaps in there. And so big gaps in there mean differences in carbon accretion, right? Differences in productivity and carbon storage. And on the landscape scale, that kind of translates to climate change, you know, or risk for it. So the process here, I think, is one of episodic saltwater intrusion. And I'm borrowing this figure from colleagues that are working on this project at FIU. This is from Tiffany Troxler and Steve Davis. And Steve and a colleague of his put together a figure that's in a report of ours from the Everglades restoration work we've been doing. But they've come up with kind of a conceptual process, and I want to say that I really like the way they did it. But if you imagine saltwater systems, this, you know, freshwater flow pushing the brackish water, keeping it at bay, so to speak, as sea level rises and we manipulate hydrology of the Everglades, which is another part of the story, we see that brackish water moving inland. And at that stage, vegetation dies back from salinity exposure, and we have this other process, this abiotic process of organic matter kind of flocculation, and we lose soil structure. Potentially that material is actually washed out of the system. And if anybody's ever seen up close what peat collapse looks like, or what we're calling peat collapse, it's not kind of mushy soil that's lost. It's gone. It is actually gone. The actual soil elevation drops, and you know the consistency of the soil is degraded, but the material is lost through time. So, parting thoughts for you guys. Protection of organic soils is critical. We know that. Saltwater intrusion can dramatically destabilize these soils, and this is both a physical and a biological process, and I think that's important to note as well. Salinity, of course, is going to change vegetation. How it does that is not so important as what the result is. And I think the resulting system, at least in this area, is that we're losing some capacity to store carbon on the landscape. And then finally, these effects will likely become more significant as climate change proceeds. One of the implications here is how we manage freshwater in the Everglades to kind of stem this. But this process is ongoing, and I think we're losing quite a bit of carbon to it. Okay, last plug. If you like mangroves and you want to talk about them, come join us in St. Augustine, Florida. This coming summer, we have the mangrove and macrobenthos meeting. And there are like two biogeochemists coming to this, so please join us. We need some soils people in the world of mangroves, so I think we could make some difference there. Okay, that's it for me. So this is an interesting issue, and I'm not sure. I'm going to go out on a limb and say that I think that small pulse of salinity doesn't necessarily wreck the whole bacterial community, but it may be like a little kick of activity goes on there. So maybe you have some sulfate reducers already present, you know, maybe ubiquitous. You give them a little something, and they get moving. But that's not sustained. And so in that experiment, I showed you one frame of a repeated experiment. That first little peak tends to be about a week long, and it's gone. And so I think if we were adding smaller amounts and not disrupting, like through cellular lysis and things like that, we might see a more gradual increase in metabolism. You know, feeding the smaller portions of the microbial community that are there that can tolerate the salt.
It's